Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Retired Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court Justice Geraldine Hines says now that she's no longer a judge, she plans to return to her activist roots. Hines was the first African-American woman on the state's highest court, appointed by former Governor Deval Patrick in 2014. She says she's seen a lot of changes since she was just one of four black students in the University of Wisconsin Law School class of 1971. But Hines also says she's watching, especially now, events that show that some things haven't changed all that much in more than four decades. When we sat down with her earlier this week, we started by asking why she decided to begin her retirement by attending the counter-protest to the so-called free speech rally in Boston on Saturday.
I retired on Friday, and I thought, what a fitting way to re-engage into the work of anti-racism. I live a stone's throw from the Reggie Lewis Center. I walked up there and I saw all the people with the wonderful signs, and the atmosphere was electric. I couldn't help myself. I felt like this is where I'm supposed to be. And I was just delighted to see people that I hadn't seen in years, because when you're a judge, you don't have a chance to associate at events and with certain kinds of people. So I was just delighted. And I've read some of the criticism of the counter-protest, that the problem is that it's stifle speech. But I'm not sure that I agree with that.
A lot of folks said that not letting the media in the bandstand.
Well, I don't know.
Not letting people in.
Yeah.
And certainly there was a concern about public safety, because it was very tense, right? Emotions
right.
were very high
right.
on both sides,
right.
and both sides were fearful.
Right.
So was it okay for authorities to cordon off the rally organizers and not let other folks listen or in because of that concern about public safety? And as a judge, and someone legally trained, I think the legal experts are saying, does that set a dangerous precedent
right.
in terms of free
well,
speech?
Well, it is. I mean, I agree. I was an ACLU person before I went on the bench, and I believe in the First Amendment. And I do think that their message, they have a right to say that. And at the same time, I think that people who disagree have the right to have their say. And I just don't know that it was possible in the circumstances to get the two groups together so that they could listen to each other. I have a feeling that if Charlottesville hadn't happened, that there would have been more of, that's not an excuse, but I have a feeling that that would have been, there would have been more of an opportunity for people to talk back to each other.
How do you describe your judicial philosophy?
Judicial philosophy.
Is there such a thing?
Well, I always associate judicial philosophy with people who are being asked to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court, because in a state appellate court, there's not that much of an opportunity to have a philosophy that you're free to weave into the decisions that the court makes.
Well, some people might say, hey, the SJC has made some decisions that certainly show a particular philosophy. Look at what we did in juvenile justice. Look what the court
right.
did there, right? And
well,
allowing,
I don't think of that as philosophy. I think of that as being committed to an evolution of fairness and justice in the law.
But what about the ruling then that said that judges can consider whether a black person who walks away from a police officer is can flee because they may have a presumed fear of police officers based on what's been happening with police officers
okay.
around the country? And
well,
you can clarify that if I'm saying it wrong.
First of all, that's really not what the decision said. And it wasn't a result of a particular philosophy. What the decision said was that in thinking about whether or not a person is engaged in criminal conduct, just because a black person in Boston flees from a police officer doesn't mean that that's not necessarily conduct that suggests consciousness of guilt.
Okay.
Because there's all of this overlay, there's all of this history of people being stopped and profiled. And it might just as easily be a way to escape an indignity as it is a way to disguise some kind of criminal intent.
But yeah. Some folks might say that's a judicial philosophy, right?
Well, you know, I'm just not going to bite on that one. you're showing some good legal skills here. I just don't see myself as having a philosophy. If there's just my one guiding light as a jurist has always been, what is just and does the law allow that to happen?
A lot of times this case gets mentioned when your name is mentioned, and that's Commonwealth versus Willie Sanders. Can you explain that case for folks briefly?
Okay.
Because it's not only, I think, a legal case that's interesting, but it's also interesting about personally what happened to you in that whole story of that case.
Oh, I didn't know you knew about that.
Well,
I was not the lead attorney, first of all, but it happened in the 70s at a time when Boston was still dealing with a lot of racial tension. Willie Sanders was a black man with no criminal record, very large family, who was charged with raping 8 different women in the Brighton neighborhood of Boston. What happened to me on a personal level was the judge in that case refused to recognize that I was a part of the defense team. When he wanted to have a conference with the lawyers on the case, he told his clerk to tell me that I couldn't come in.
Because you were a black woman?
Yes. Hmm. Tell that girl she can't come in. And so I was a brand new lawyer then, and I was a lot less restrained, let me say, than I came to be later on in my career, and we took care of that. And it worked out for the defendant in the case because we got a new judge who was committed to choosing a fair jury for the case, and the Willie Sanders was acquitted.
And then you took the judge's seat.
I did.
Yeah.
Yes, I did. The supreme irony of that. Things have a way of working out.
So what would you say when you look back on all of the cases and the opinions from the court? What are the ones that you feel strongest about?
I think it's a very collegial court. And for the 3 years that I was there, there was never a large disagreement about any decision that the court made. But I can think of a couple that I'm really proud to have been associated with, and not being immodest here, but one that I contributed to writing, the decision about where convicted sex offenders, registered sex offenders, can live. I think it takes a lot to understand why the law should protect a person's right to be, no matter what crime they've committed. Mm. And in that situation, we had citizen towns all over the Commonwealth passing ordinances or developing regulations that people who are registered sex offenders can't live within certain places in their towns. And when you have a whole lot of towns doing that, that means that people aren't able to live anywhere. And that's a very difficult thing to explain to lay people who mm-hmm. are understandably concerned about who lives next to them. But, you know, I'm really proud that our court understood the liberty interests, right, protecting people. They've got to live somewhere. So
What do you hope your legacy will be?
Well, I hope it's that I was somebody who committed to justice, equal justice, committed to fairness, and always on the lookout for a way to make that happen within the bounds of the law.
Is it sort of bittersweet to leave?
Mostly sweet. Only a little bit bitter. Bitter because all along the way I've made some wonderful friends. I've had a chance to do a lot of the work that I wanted to do. But sweet in the sense that there's so much going on in the country right now that I feel I should be involved in. And I obviously can't do that as a judge. In many respects, it feels just like the country that existed in 1971 when I came to Boston as a new lawyer. Jim Crow had only recently been vanquished, and now it's almost 50 years later, and some of those same issues that got me into the law are begging for attention today.
Yeah.
And I'm free to get involved.
Right, right. So what might that look like for you, do you know?
Well,
you're going to give us some news here?
No. The real pressing issue, I think, is what is happening with voting rights.
But when you look at it and you say voting rights was an issue 50 years ago that people were fighting, and they're still fighting. And when you look at the criticism of the criminal justice system and all of the coverage of police shootings and mass incarceration, I wonder how you don't get discouraged.
Well, you do. Hmm. Of course you're discouraged that after 50 years you're fighting a battle that you thought you had won. But that's the nature of racism. That's the nature of oppression. It's not ever really defeated, I think. And I think the people who are committed to working and fighting this issue understand that they're going to take one step forward and two steps backwards sometimes. But yes, you are discouraged, but that's the nature of the beast.
Well, Justice Geraldine Hines retired from the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court Friday. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, the father of the medical thriller, novelist Robin Cook. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.